Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, October 11th, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we'll hear a special Courthouse Steps teleforum discussing oral argument in National Association of Manufacturers versus the Department of Defense. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today we are happy to have with us Reed Hopper, Senior Attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation. I will turn it over to Mr. Hopper to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for sitting with us. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the invitation to report on the case. Let me just give a little background for those of you who may not be familiar with the case, and then I'll give you a blow-by-blow of what happened in oral argument today at the Supreme Court. Back in June of 2015, the Corps of Engineers and the Environmental Protection Agency issued a regulation defining the scope of the Clean Water Act, in particular outlining the navigable waters or waters of the United States subject to federal control and regulation. This is known as the WOTUS rule for waters of the United States. It was immediately assailed by all sides, including us at Pacific Legal Foundation. 30 states filed suit, 70 different entities. We represented 11 different associations, mostly farmers and small business and livestock growers and the like from seven different states. Virtually all of these parties filed their original complaints in the district courts. There were 11 different district courts that were involved in these initial suits. The government immediately moved to consolidate these cases. However, the multi-district panel decided that they were not appropriate for consolidation. So it looked like the cases were going to go forward on different fronts and in various district courts throughout the country. The basis for challenging the WOTUS rule varied. There were procedural challenges. For example, the most prominent is that the final rule did not look like the proposed rule. And so the argument was raised in most of our complaints that notice and comment requirements of the Administrative Procedure Act had not been met. There were also a number of substantive challenges. For example, that the new rule was inconsistent with the plain language of the Clean Water Act, that it misinterpreted the Supreme Court case law interpreting the act, and also that the rule itself exceeded federal constitutional limits with respect to states' rights and also the Commerce Clause. After these cases had been decided to go forward separately in the district courts, the EPA pushed the idea that the act itself required that this type of rule that designated jurisdiction was subject to the venue provision in the Clean Water Act. That provision essentially says that if the EPA is involved in promulgating any effluent limitation or other limitation, or is involved in approving or denying any permit, then such a case would need to be brought directly in the appellate court and not the district court. There were a number of challenges to that interpretation in several different courts of appeal, but ultimately the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeal bought that argument, and so all of those of us who had filed in the district court, filed protective petitions in the appellate courts corresponding to our district court regions, and they were consolidated in the Sixth Circuit. So that's where the case now resides with respect to the question of the validity of the rule. But as I indicated, the other aspects of the rule or the case is which court has jurisdiction to hear any challenges to this jurisdictional definition expressed by the Corps and EPA in the WOTUS rule. And that's the question that ultimately found its way to the Supreme Court. And the court today heard oral arguments in that case. And the specific question to the court was whether the venue provision under the endangered under the Clean Water Act, as I just described, directs that the WOTUS rule be challenged through the appellate court, which would limit any challenges to 120 days. That would be the statute of limitations. If on the other hand, the court ruled that the challenges could be brought directly in the district courts, then they would be subject to the normal statute of limitations under the Administrative Procedure Act, which is 6 years. So today, in the hearing, it went pretty much as those of us who had originally challenged the rule thought it might go. We feel that the court was sympathetic to our view that the district court is the proper venue and not the appellate court. Arguing for National Association of Manufacturing was Tim Bishop. He shared time with Eric Murphy, who represented the states. He's from Ohio. And then for the Solicitor General, it was Rachel Coyner. The the initial argument by Tim Bishop and Eric Murphy was fairly slow. There were long periods of time when no questions were being asked. I guess you could call it a cold bench, in a sense, because they were allowed a great deal of time to explain, expand on their answers. But a few questions came their way, starting with Chief Justice Roberts, who I think his first question was kind of a throwaway question, just echoing the other side. It was to Tim Bishop, and it was, isn't it more efficient, he asked, to simply allow direct challenges in the circuit courts of appeal, where we have to only deal with one court and not burden the district courts. They're all going to have to separately read a very lengthy administrative record. Tim Bishop responded that this court, Supreme Court, had stated in Sackett that access to the court really trumped efficiency, and efficiency has never been the standard for determining a proper venue. He also remarked that if you look at all the cases that the Supreme Court had considered dealing with jurisdiction under the Clean Water Act, going all the way back to Riverside Bayview, then Swank, Rapanos, Sackett, and Hawks, those all came up through the district courts, and they were all remanded as appropriate back to the appropriate district courts. Justice Kagan picked up the thread that was argued by the EPA in the briefs. She asked, well, as a hypothetical, what if instead of simply defining the jurisdictional contours of the Clean Water Act, the rule had specified certain limits on quantities and types of discharges? Would that have made a difference? Mr. Bishop indicated that that would have been a closer call, but still would not satisfy the requirements under the venue provision, because the venue provision indicates that it only applies when there's a promulgation under Section 1311 which relates to effluent limitations. And this is not, the quotas rule was a jurisdictional, definitional, and did not involve any sort of effluent limitation promulgation. Also, Justice Kagan suggested, well, maybe Congress really wanted to have a broad reading of the venue provision for the sake of convenience and administrative efficiency. And again, Mr. Bishop responded, yes, perhaps, but that's not the language that the Congress decided on, and we have to live with that language as it appears in the Act. She did ask a question which I thought was very interesting. During the prior to the argument last Friday, I was involved in the moot court. There was a question I intended to ask and didn't, but she asked it, and the question was, can you think of a reason why Congress would treat effluent limitations differently than the 404 dredge and fill type permits? Because all the parties agree that under the Clean Water Act, 404 dredge and fill permits and the like, anything related to them, are to be challenged in the district courts, whereas NPDES, EPA effluent guidelines and the like would be subject to media jurisdiction in the appellate court. So her question went to why the distinction. If Mr. Bishop had any idea, he said he could not think of any. She was a little surprised at that, but didn't offer a solution. I've thought about it myself. I think that Congress was decided that there needed to be a more efficient means of reviewing effluent guidelines because they would cover entire industries, whereas a discharge fill is a very discrete, localized event. And so it makes sense that there would be a need to get a quick and expedited resolution of broad regional effluent guidelines, but not necessarily for dredge and fill type discharges. Justice Kagan also made the point that isn't the geography, the question of jurisdiction, so bound up with effluent limitations that it makes sense to treat them the same? And again, this just echoes the position of the EPA. And again, the response was that, well, that's not what the text says, and we need to live with that. Justice Sotomayor chimed in about that time, and she zeroed in on the language. And as I indicated before, under one subheading of the venue provision, it says that appellate courts have original jurisdiction to review rules that are promulgated and to set any effluent limitation or any other limitations. So she asked Mr. Bishop, can you name any other limitation? And he recited the other provisions immediately following those venue standards and pointed out that planning, methodology, and those kind of things would fall under the category of other limitation, and he emphasized that he didn't think that the term any other limitation was meant as a catch-all that would take into account the entire WOTUS rule. Justice Ginsburg had a few questions, but the one that I noted in particular was she raised a concern about the proposal that's now on the table as directed by the president to withdraw the WOTUS rule and to revise it. She was wondering what the timing would be on that, how it might affect the case, and Mr. Bishop simply indicated he didn't know what the timing was on that, so we'd have to wait and see. And we turn now to the questioning of the government attorney, and this is where the court really came alive. They obviously were saving their powder for the government attorney. he hand from the moment she stood up. It was a very hot bench. Kagan continued to ask questions, but now she switched her approach. She asked specifically, don't we have to give effect to the language of the venue provision that applies only to rules promulgated under Section 1311? And the government attorney asserted that the WOTUS rule, which defines the jurisdiction of the entire Clean Water Act, was promulgated under 1311. Justice Kagan responded, well, your own brief says that it was promulgated under the general rulemaking provision, not Section 1311. And the government attorney said, well, it's actually both. Justice Alito jumped in saying, how can you say that a definitional rule is the same as an effluent limitation? Government attorney response was, well, they're inseparable. You have to know the geography before you can set the limits, so they should be considered. he also raised the question, Alito did, you know, if a landowner wants to challenge a jurisdiction, what court should he bring it in? And the government attorney said that she really didn't know. That struck Alito as odd. He said, well, if you can't be sure what court, then how can the landowner or the regulated public be expected to know where to bring their suit? And they talked a little bit back and forth about how that could raise a due process concern. Jumping on the bandwagon with Alito's concern about the landowner and which court and whether we needed a bright line rule and at least some clarity, Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Gorsuch jumped in and said, you know, but what is, how can we have a bright line rule if we don't follow the plain text? And Justice Sotomayor specifically asked the government attorney, what would be the rule that you're asking us to adopt? And she said that the rule that she would propose is that the Supreme Court say that whenever a rule is promulgated under Section 1311, that it gets review in the appellate court, not the district court. The problem I see with that is that that's the very question before the court. So it kind of begs the question. It wasn't really an answer. Justice Ginsburg brought up the question of mootness once again. If the rule, WOTUS rule, is rescinded, what does that do to this case? The government attorney said that it would moot the case. However, it's certainly capable of repetition because we're going to see a new rule. The jurisdictional question is still alive that needs to be addressed. And Chief Justice Roberts agreed with that, and I would too. Chief Justice Roberts then took the floor. He indicated that he thought that the most ordinary meaning would be a plain text reading of the venue provision, which doesn't seem to apply to a definitional rule outlining the contours of Clean Water Act as opposed to specific limitations. The government attorney indicated that in Crown Simpson, the court had taken a not-so-literal view and simply looked at a practical reading. And since a jurisdictional question is indelibly bound up with the question of the effluent limitation, they should be considered the same. However, Chief Justice Roberts said that Crown Simpson was easily distinguishable. In that case, EPA actually denied a permit which satisfied the language of the venue provision. And he went on to express concern that with adopting the government's view because of the 120-day statute limitation window, he thought that would be too short for most landowners. A farmer would need perhaps years in order to determine whether the rule applied, and the only way to really ensure that access and ability to challenge the rule facially would be to go with the broader APA standard 6-year limitation within the district court. Justice Kennedy, as I recall, only raised one question, and it was to the government attorney. He asked, are you saying that a definitional rule is the same as an effluent limitation? Her response was, well, here, yes, because they're inseparable. Justice Thomas, as usual, didn't have any questions. Now, Justice Breyer was interesting in his response. We predicted during the moot court that what we really needed to be watching for during the oral argument was Justice Breyer's response. I argued the Hawks case last year. That was the case in which we argued that when the Corps of Engineers or EPA issues a jurisdictional determination, a specific site-specific determination, that that's final agency action, and that under the Administrative Procedure Act, it should be subject to judicial review for 40 years. The courts have held that that's not the case. However, the Supreme Court in the Hawks decision agreed with us in a unanimous decision. What was interesting during the oral argument in the Hawks decision was Justice Breyer adopted our view and essentially made our argument with the long exegesis during the oral argument. And he did essentially the same thing here. And so we were looking for that because we really feel that Justice Breyer would set the tone or at least be reflective of the tone and mindset of the court as a whole. And so he immediately leaned forward. He made our argument, the petitioner's argument, that we need to give the language its plain reading. There's obviously Congress intended effluent limitations to be treated differently than jurisdictional questions or 404 questions and the like. So he went on at some length, really just pontificating rather than asking questions, and essentially ended up saying how are you going to square that, and there really isn't much response to that except to reiterate, as the government attorney did, that look at both of these are the jurisdictional questions just a basis for setting the effluent limitation, and they got to be considered separately or together. Finally, Justice Sotomayor raised the question, that the government has a difficult time trying to get past the plain language, because as she reads it, it really doesn't cover the definitional rule that we see in the WOTUS regulation. So that's it for me. That's the background, and that's the blow-by-blow. I predict that there'll be a clear majority in favor of the petitioners saying that the Clean Water Act requires challenges to the WOTUS rule to be brought in the district court. It would not surprise me if, like in Hawks and Sackett, we got a unanimous decision. Any questions?
Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. While we wait for that first question, I'll make a brief announcement. Our next Teleforum conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Thursday, October 12th at 3 p.m. We'll be discussing David Dorson's newest book, The Unexpected Scalia, A Conservative Justice's Liberal Opinions, with the author and former Scalia clerk Professor Michael Ramsey and Dean Alan B. Morrison. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any questions, I can ask one of my own. Do you have any prediction for when this decision will come out? Do you think it'll be towards the end of the term, or it'll be a quick turnaround?
Yeah, I'm hoping that the court is anticipating that there may be a new rule and that we really need to get a quick turnaround. So it wouldn't surprise me if we got a decision by the end of the year. That would be certainly expedited, but I think under the circumstance it is possible we're going to get a decision sooner rather than later.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. You said that a lot of the oral argument went how you expected. Were there any surprises today?
There wasn't, except for the one question by Justice Kagan that I indicated that I had intended to ask during the moot court, which was, you know, can you think of any reason why the Congress would treat the effluents different than the discharge, you know, the dredge and fill type discharges. So that was the only surprise. Otherwise, everything went almost exactly as we thought it might.
I'll make a final call for questions. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleforum calls and to consult the full schedule of our upcoming Teleforum calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded Teleforum calls you may have missed. Not seeing any questions, would you like to make any closing remarks?
No, but thank you for the opportunity.
Great. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our expert for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.